Avoidance always will win short term because it's quick, it's fast, it brings you that quick relief. Question is, will it lead to the life that you want to live?
Welcome to season one of Neural Compass, the Jiminy podcast, where we explore the future of mental and behavioral health at the intersection of clinical care and cutting edge AI. I'm your host, Mark Jacobstein, co-founder and president of Jiminy Health. Each week, we sit down with the thinkers, builders, and leaders shaping what's next, from healthcare executives to AI pioneers, to uncover the ideas driving real innovation. This week, I'm really honored to be speaking to Dr. Luana Marquez. Dr. Marquez is an old friend and is a nationally recognized clinical psychologist, researcher, and author who currently serves as associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. She's also the past president of Anxiety and Depression Association of America, and is the founder and director of Community Psychiatry Pride at Mass General Hospital. In this week's episode, Dr. Marquez talks to us about the crisis in access and equity in mental health and the work that she's done through her organization Pride to help address this. It's a fascinating episode. I hope you're able to join. If you don't mind, you've had an extraordinary journey from growing up in Brazil to ending up as a professor here at Harvard Medical School by way of Buffalo. By the way, I'm very, as a native of Rochester, New York, always happy to see Western New York in the mix. If you don't mind, for our listeners, sort of give us a little bit about the path here.
Sure, Mark. Yeah, delighted to be here with you. And so I grew up in Brazil with a single mother. I went through a lot of trauma and adversity. And early on in my life, about 15, I learned a lot of what I eventually learned to be cognitive behavior therapy from my grandmother. She really helped me change the way I saw the world, the way of my limiting beliefs. And that propelled me. I came to the U.S. first as an exchange student, eventually back for college. And since 2005, I've been in Harvard Medical School. I started as an instructor. Today, I'm associate professor. And I am really passionate about bringing evidence-based skills and therapy to inner city youth who, you know, had as many challenges as I had growing up.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being here. And I think I just recently learned that, in fact, your exchange program in high school was in Buffalo, and then later you did graduate work in Buffalo. It just could not get enough. I think there's no better training for resilience than a Western New York winter. So
that is so true. You know, the first time when you come to the U.S. as an exchange student, they can send you anywhere, or they send me to Buffalo. So coming from Brazil to Buffalo as an exchange student, not speaking any English, it was really hard, really, really hard, really cold. But then when I decided to come back for college, my American family, who I still talk to on a weekly basis, I call them mom and dad still, they were there. And so Buffalo was.
Fantastic. So let's talk about your book. And for me, there's a lot of things that are interesting about the book. I start with sort of a quote, like the only path forward is through my emotions. One of the things I think is really interesting about the book is that it's all about avoiding avoidance. And the fact that a lot of the work that is done in psychology and with patients who are struggling with things like anxiety and depression is to take on what you think of as more the symptoms, like anxiety, as opposed to what are some of the real root causes of unhappiness, perhaps, which for you ultimately boils down to avoidance. And I think it's a really interesting thesis and not necessarily something that is exactly mainstream within psychology. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. So maybe give us an overview of the book for folks who are interested.
Yeah, so the book's premise, as I think you highlighted nicely, Mark, is the idea that when we get anxious or depressed or scared, that, you know, those things are horrible, but really that's not the problem. The problem is what we do in those moments. And for most people, they avoid. So you are scared of going on a date, and so you don't go on a date, and your brain learns that going on a date is scary. And so avoidance for me is the real infection. It comes out of 20 years at Harvard Medical School studying psychology, from randomized controlled trials to working with inner city individuals to working with billionaires, and looking at this common denominator for everybody that gets us stuck. You know, our brain is wired to protect us from threat. But unfortunately, our brain can't separate real threat from imaginary threat. So when we get an email from our boss saying we need to talk, we have the same response. And then sometimes we get stuck and we avoid. And so the book came, I wrote it during the pandemic when my wait list was 2 years long in my private practice. And I just felt like there's such a problem in terms of access to high quality evidence-based skills that a lot of the self-help books out there are really based on people's opinion, not science. And for me as a scientist, I wanted to have a science-driven book. And so that's why I wrote Bold Move.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. And I'm curious because, so, you know, my own journey, I public about this, I struggled with anxiety personally for 15 or 20 years, and really mightily with anxiety for probably a decade. And there's a lot in your book that really resonates for me, including the fact that ultimately anxiety causing avoidance was the thing that then for me triggered what I'll say unhappiness and or depression, because it was, you end up not doing the things you hope to do, perhaps not living a values-driven life if those values include doing certain things that are important to you, but you're avoiding them because of your anxiety, you end up in a bad place. And that was all very resonant for me. I will say one thing that was interesting, though, is at least for me, I feel like anxiety was the initial trigger that when I struggled with anxiety, it felt like it came from nowhere. It probably didn't, but it felt like it came from nowhere. And it was such a terrible initial kick in the pants. It came with panic attacks and all the rest of it, that for me, at least, I don't think avoidance was the trigger, but avoidance ended up perhaps being the problem. And I think it's an interesting thing. I don't know if you see this with folks' journeys. It feels to me like there's sort of, you talk about other cycles, the thoughts, emotions, behavior cycles. It feels to me like there's a little bit of a anxiety, avoidance, depression cycle as well. And I don't know if that resonates for you with what you see with your patients.
Well, sorry to hear about all that anxiety. I hope is doing better for you.
And much better for quite some time. Thank you.
Right. So it's interesting, especially in the case of panic, right? So a panic attack can be cued or uncued. Let's just use the example you gave us. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's uncued. You're driving in the grocery store, you're watching TV, it came out of nowhere. And again, the brain is designed to protect us. And so that physiology coming out of nowhere is interpreted as something bad versus, you know, I went for a run and I'm out of breath and I'm gasping for air. That is not a problem. I don't see that as a problem, but I'm gasping for air. My stomach dropped and now I feel like I'm out of control. Panic attack. Then your brain goes, this is really bad. Right. And then once you have that first panic attack, you can go in a couple of directions, right? For you, it probably got you stuck and you continue to experience, and then you start to avoid anything that could trigger that kind of sensation, hence the avoidance. Right? So it's a chicken and egg kind of question, though, right? The panic came, then you avoid, and now you're stuck. And then you get depression and the cycles that you're talking about. Some people have a panic attack. I've had one in my life as an adult. It's an interesting story, Mark. My entire dog career for the last 20 years treating patients, they've asked me if I had, and I really hadn't had a panic attack. But writing Bold Move, I realized that as a kid, I had a lot of panic attacks, and I just didn't realize that.
Didn't have language for it.
Right? And I didn't have language, exactly. But today, you know, when I had a panic attack as an adult, I was like, oh, this is all my brain having a brain fart. This is nothing. And I didn't move on to avoiding anything. Therefore, it becomes just physiology. Right? Oh. And that's the main difference. The reason I focus so much on the avoidance is that path of I can tolerate physiology and continue to public speak, get on a plane, ride my car versus not is what leads to the disorder versus not. And for me, I've never treated somebody that had anxiety or depression that wasn't avoiding. I've never seen that.
Right. That all resonates for me. And what's interesting is, I mean, I've literally read dozens and dozens of books that reference CBT and other evidence-based treatment plans that are sort of at the core of modern psychological treatment these days. I've never heard somebody talk about, until your book, avoidance as the crux instead of anxiety as the crux. It makes an awful lot of sense to me. I'm curious, I mean, because, I mean, literally, among other things, when we give somebody a diagnosis, usually that diagnosis is typically, it's anxiety or it's depression. There are variations on this, eating disorders, things that sort of fall away from these things, obsessive compulsive disorder, et cetera. But I've never heard somebody describe, I don't know that avoidance is actually diagnosable, but it actually, I don't know that there's a code, but it feels to me like there is something very important there in the way that sort of sits at to your point, is that's the challenge. And anxiety is sort of a symptom on top of it. How do you think about that in terms of like the overarching structure and the forces at work in the world of like the APA and how psychologists talk about this? I mean, among other things, there's probably no CPT code associated with treating somebody for avoidance as opposed to anxiety. Is this something you feel like needs to sort of change within the field?
I think there are two separate questions that you're bringing up here. One is, what is the state of our diagnostic system and what it holds and all the research behind it, how it came to develop? And, you know, today, a lot of this is driven by insurance codes, as you said, CPT codes that make something billable and so that we can bill insurance company about it. But we know scientifically there's huge comorbidity, right? That you have somebody that has generalized anxiety disorder and depression, you're going to have symptoms that are sleep symptoms that are the same for both of these disorders, right? And so we know there's comorbidity and we know those codes. Now, if I zoom out from CPT codes and how insurance are run and think about holistically treating an individual in front of me and really think about the core of cognitive behavior therapy, you know, I got trained by one of David Barlow's student and then talked to David about this many times. He's sort of the father of CBT for anxiety disorders. And all the interviews were, what is the focus of fear? And what is, and what, if you look at it, there's a focus of fear that leads to avoidance. So if you have social anxiety disorders, your focus of fear is that people are going to evaluate you negatively and judge you badly. And what do? You avoid the situations. You right. have obsessive compulsive disorders. You're afraid of obsessions that are contamination, for example. What you do, you avoid anything and you clean again and again. So if you look at the diagnosis, avoidance is there. And in the treatment protocols, we are targeting avoidance in every single treatment protocol. And I'm going to be very direct, I guess, is the way I think about this. You know, when I think about this, my colleagues and I all wrote books and slice and dice in many ways. But if we look at it, we're talking about the same thing, right?
Right.
And so I wanted to simplify it because I think for the regular clinician in a clinic, not in the ivory towers of Harvard or Stanford, they need something simplistic that can apply with their patients. And I think it actually leads to better outcomes.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting because in many ways, what the treatment paradigms that you're proposing are ultimately, it's still CBT. And we'll talk a little bit about the TEB cycle and how you think about the specific applications to this. But it feels to me like it's the most pragmatic version of CBT I've ever read about, where like the point is there are things in your life that you want to be doing, but are not, or are things in your life that you don't want to be doing, but you are. Maybe the driving force that is causing that might be a form of anxiety, but the manifestation of this that is making you ultimately unhappy is the avoidant behavior. And a lot of very practical techniques in the book for somebody to, so how do you take that on? And maybe we're going to talk about all of them, but the one that I feel is like most germane for people is like, okay, so I spend too much time scrolling, right? I'm doom scrolling, I'm reading the news, the internet is everywhere, right? And we have a dopamine machine in our pocket that just makes things worse. I think the accessibility of avoidance via sort of disappearing into scrolling probably makes things even worse for people. It's just easier to avoid than it was for, you know, our ancestors. So talk a little bit about what somebody's doing when that behavior happens and how you think about somebody sort of curing that in effect.
So I think maybe what we should do is define avoidance, because I think most people don't really understand avoidance the way I conceptualize avoidance. Yeah. And I think the trick about avoidance is not about what we do, is the why behind what we do. The function of avoidance is to bring our discomfort down. And so in the case of scrolling on social media, right, I'm having a bad day. I had a fight with my husband. My heart is pounding. And I'm like, I just feel so uncomfortable. I have to make myself feel better. Right. And the brain doesn't like that discomfort. The brain has to do something to cool yourself down. And so we go on social media. And as you said, it's a dopamine machine. Pretty quickly, you're getting some feel good, you know, dopamine. At the same time, you're disconnecting for whatever was creating that conflict for you. So you bring that temperature down. That's why I define avoidance as something that's a quick fix. It makes you feel better momentarily. The problem is it has a high price tag. Because now you're training your brain that the only way to manage conflict, I'm just using this as an example, in your relationship is to go on your phone. next thing you know, we have conflict at work and you're going on your phone again. Momentarily, you feel better, but you never regulate your brain. You never teach your brain that, you know what? I can manage discomfort. You know what? I can get to your quote in the beginning. I can go through my emotions to get to the other side. And I think that is how the first step that is the hardest is this, is even identifying that you're avoiding. I work with so many people. Give another example of you work with a lot of high power people. I do too. And for executives, right, who are CEOs, presidents of companies I work with, they're like, I'm not avoiding. I'm just working nonstop and I'm just on top of things. I'm not avoiding anything. And yet they can't tolerate sitting for a second. They can't unplug, right? They're feeling exhausted. They're feeling on edge. They feel like they don't have values. And yet they are, you know, stuck on avoiding because they're reacting to avoid.
So in well, in fact, I recall somewhere in the book, I don't remember, you had a wonderful phrase for it that I'm forgetting it, but the kind of work people do, I like to say sometimes to people I work with, don't mistake activity for progress. I'm keeping myself busy and the work, all the work I'm doing is at least in some way important and I'm checking something off of a list and there's probably the sort of relaxation dopamine effect of checking something off the list, but I'm not actually doing the thing that I need to be doing and that I know that I need to be doing, which is harder. And because it's harder, it's making me anxious because I'm not quite sure I know the answer. And that is, it's its own sort of, maybe it's productive procrastination. Is that what you called it?
Exactly. All right.
Yeah. I recognize that certainly in myself, but I and most of the people I know who are busy.
Yeah. I mean, the trick here is do the thing they don't want to do, but it's the most important thing that's aligned with your values first thing in the morning. So if I am procrastinating, I will get up and I will do that thing first thing, and then I'll have my cup of coffee. Like I even put a condition that I can't even have a cup of coffee to just get me to the skill in the book is approach instead of avoid. So really taking steps towards discomfort, because when we do it, we see that the monster is not as big as it was in our head.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't know if I'm sure people have studied this or looked into this more closely. I recall it's almost like 35 years ago now, when I was an undergrad, I had a college roommate who was studying psychology, and he came home one day and he explained to me something called the matching law. And the basic notion of the matching law is it sort of posits that the relative rate of response for multiple options. Like if you're a rat and you've got levers you can press and you're going to get more pellets from this lever than from that lever, you're going to press the lever that gives you more pellets more often. And relative to the amount of pellets you get is how often you will press the lever. What was really interesting, and this was my college roommate, Larry, saying to me this 35 years ago, is that human beings basically follow the matching law also, which is not surprising. Like, of course, if you press the lever and you get pellets, why wouldn't you do it? The issue is that it's a short term, and they studied the matching law and they demonstrated that even if pressing lever one was going to get you more pellets in the long run, more in the long run, but fewer in the short run, and lever two was the opposite, the rats were always going to go for the short term win. Well, it turns out that humans also did reasonably. Like, and I feel like in some ways that's part of what's happening in this anxiety/avoidance dyad is in the short run, I'm avoiding the hard task. I'm avoiding the hard conversation. I'm avoiding making the hard decision. I feel better right now. But over time, my general position in life and am I driving towards the values I care about are going to decline. And I don't know if the two are related, but they feel like they probably are.
No, avoidance always will win short term because it's quick, it's fast, it brings you that quick relief, and it will win. The question is, will it lead to the life that you want to live? I think you brought up values many times, Mark, and I think that's in the end of it. Are we doing the things that are aligned with our values? Because when we do, we know scientifically, we live better lives. We're less depressed. We're less anxious. You know, it's not all bliss, but we can tolerate a lot more pain when it is aligned with something that matters. Is that most people don't pause and say, what do I really want in my life? What's my why? What's the why driving me? And without that, then we're going to press the lever that gives the quick release.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you also talk about in the book is sort of this notion of opposite actions in motion in moments of emotional distress. And I'd love to hear you describe them and maybe also talk about one of the things, as you know, at Jiminy, one of the things we're trying to do is use artificial intelligence to help therapists in the process of helping their patients. And one of the things I think about are like well-timed personalized nudges, for example, that you can give to people in moments of emotional distress that would perhaps help drive sort of better in the long run behaviors for them. So talk about this sort of opposite action notion.
Yeah, so opposite action was first tested by Marshall Linehan under the umbrella of dialectical behavior therapy, which is a type of cognitive behavior therapy. First tested for individuals with borderline personality disorders, but then generalized across many concepts. And the idea here is this: whenever we feel distress, let's use anxiety, right? Anxiety dictates that we avoid. It basically commands your brain to walk away from whatever it is the focus of fear. You don't go on a date. You don't tell somebody you're upset with them. You walk away. Opposite action is taking a small step towards discomfort to basically train your brain that you can tolerate it. So, and what I love about it, and for Jiminy, in the way you described it is really powerful, is that in that moment when you're about to go in for your job review and you're going to ask for a raise, your brain's going to tell you, don't do it, right? But if you get a text message and says, we agreed, you're going to do this, take a step towards it. It's much more, I mean, I do this in my clinic with my patients. Sometimes I know they're going to face something. I put on my calendar, I send them a text, and they go, thank you so much. They helped me do it. Right? They're not alone doing it.
That's amazing that you do that for your patients, by the way. But that is, to your point, exactly the kind of thing we hope software systems that work in conjunction with your therapist can do for them. Because one of the core premises is we have, like, a therapist can't be there for you 168 hours a week, but an AI working in conjunction with a therapist can be. And it's easier for it to be integrated into your sort of daily life.
100%. I mean, and for any of us using AI effectively, we can see the advantage of it. Like how fast you can be more productive and great at it. And some of this stuff, and you said, you know, bold move is pragmatic. I wrote it that way because I do think in modern psychology, we've made cognitive behavior therapy in particular so theoretically heavy. And yet the principles are so simple. Right. And a text message that says, take the opposite action, do this. It's much more likely to have somebody actually go do it. Because at the end of the day, that's what we want. We want people to become their own psychologists. We want them to know how to rewire their own brain and then to be their own personal trainers for life. I don't want to be their therapist forever. My best day.
That's great to hear. And of course, there's also a message payers love to hear, which is actually quite important, is that, to your point, you want to train people to get good enough at this that they can largely do it on their own, if not maybe perhaps exclusively do it on their own, and graduate from needing a therapist, at least until there's sort of something happens in their life, maybe. But this is something that we think software can be very, very important for helping with.
I think you're right on the ball there, Mark. I mean, I think for myself personally, I've had a personal trainer that I exercised physically for many, many years. I recently moved, lost my personal trainer. I couldn't find another one. And honestly, I got a personal trainer that had an app, and I talked to him once. He sent me the thing. He happens to be in Brazil, so I really like it. He speaks Portuguese. And next thing you know, I'm back to the gym 3 times a week by just taking that barrier out. And I think if Jiminy can do that, and take some of those barriers out, then we can increase access to so many people because we know we need.
Somebody needs to study. I mean, we certainly think the human in conjunction with the conversational AI dynamic, I think, is very interesting, because having the human personal trainer or human therapist involved lends a kind of accountability that I think is very, very important. And as you know, therapeutic alliance is really important in terms of whether or not somebody's going to do well in therapy. I think probably similarly true with personal training, having a personal trainer that you like and also feel a little bit responsible to. But yes, then the personal trainer can send you the other 3 workouts for the week, and you're likely to do them in a way that, like, yeah, I could go find them on the internet, but it's different because I'm accountable. Yeah. So shifting gears entirely here, I'd love to talk about equity and access, because I know that's been a real focus for you in your academic career and pragmatically with a lot of the work that you do. I mean, for folks who are listening who aren't aware, the NIMH thinks that on the order of 1 in 5 Americans has some mental health challenge that amounts to a little over 60 million people. There are roughly 250,000 therapists in the country, and that includes everybody from LCSWs to psychologists to psychiatrists, anybody who is sort of licensed to practice therapy in the country, the mismatch is wild, right? That's a 240-to-1 ratio. And I think probably they're underdiagnosing the number of people who face mental health challenges. The way this manifests in part is, not surprisingly, the people who do have access to good care are affluent knowledge workers on the coast. And, you know, there are all sorts of marginalized and disadvantaged communities that really have almost no access to mental health care. And it's a huge challenge for the field. You spent a lot of time both studying this and working on it. And maybe I'll ask you to start by describing, did you build Pride? I know you're the director of Pride. Yeah. So tell our listeners about what Pride is, why you built it, and what you've learned in the process of running it.
So the beginning of my career, the first 10 years or so, I worked mostly in randomized controlled trial, trying to test CBT, how it worked. And then I got really frustrated. About 2013, I worked in the main campus in Boston, MS General Hospital, and I went to volunteer a day a week in our community clinic in Chelsea. So literally you cross the Topin Bridge and you get to an inner city community. And when I got there, all of the therapists were doing dream analysis for post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, we had 20 years of randomized controlled trials showing that we had several types of evidence-based treatments. I got patients better in 10 weeks, sometimes 9 weeks completely, with severe histories of trauma. And so that was my first pulse on what I understood then to be the gap between science and practice. Right. We know that takes about 17 years for science to get into practice. Only 14% of science actually get into practice. And when we talk about inner city communities like Chelsea, most of the providers are not trained on evidence-based practice. So that's why I built Community Psychiatry Pride, which is a program on research and implementation and dissemination of evidence-based treatments. So my passion at that moment is I'm going to train as many psychologists as possible. Well, I learned the hard way that that was not going to solve the problem because of the data you just said, Mark.
There just aren't enough psychologists. You can train all of them. They could all be good at their jobs and practicing evidence-based medicine, and that would be a start, but it would barely scratch the surface.
So at that point, 20% of the U.S. population needed mental health care. 0.17% were trained. This is 2014. And so I did the first study. I trained myself as an implementation scientist. But then, since then, I've developed programs that really think about CBT, not as therapy, but actually as skills. And so I created a program with inner city young men coming out of prison. Then I worked with high schools. Now I have a project with Barbara Dalio in Connecticut, which we work with nonprofit organizations who serve inner city youth. And I literally train paraprofessionals on CBT as strategists. They train to the inner city youth. And so the idea here is, who is responsible for the mental health of youth? Who is the people I'm the most passionate about? In my mind, anybody that touches that youth. And so if I can teach a paraprofessional to do opposite action, I can teach a paraprofessional to charge up, which is behavior activation. And the interesting thing is, the way we got this is I workshop CBT with a bunch of inner city youth, high school students. And that's how I got to the TAB cycle. I said, you know, let's talk about the CBT cycle. And they're like, no, we like TAB. We like thoughts, emotions, and behaviors, because that makes sense for us.
Right.
And so we did like a whole study through a summer to really get to CBT, not drop voltage, not drop fidelity to CBT, but bring it into skills. And our papers show that inner city young men coming out of prison, if they use one of the 10 skills, they're 65% more likely to stay in a job. That means they are not on the streets. They're not shooting somebody. They are actually contributing to society. To me, that's where we need to go. We need to get CBT in as many places to build resilience as possible so that we can bring down this tidal wave of mental health.
I've read several of your papers, but the sort of culmination of this was a paper called Effectiveness of Modular Cognitive Behavioral Skills Curriculum in High-Risk Justice-Involved Youth. We'll include the link in the podcast so people can go read the article. It's very compelling. And for me, this goes back to something we talked about earlier in the book, is sort of this pragmatic approach. CBT is about building skills. You need to develop a curriculum that allows for the developing of those skills in a way that is sort of with language that is going to reach the communities, right? Even the cognitive behavioral therapy, well, thoughts, emotions, and behaviors, great. very straightforward. Here are the skills we're going to learn, and the ability to train, you know, again, non-PhD level professionals to implement this, I think is just really profound. And it frankly, very similar to how we're thinking about AI as a way to help augment the work that psychiatrists, psychologists, master's level LCSWs, et cetera, are doing already, because we simply can't train enough. I mean, we could have 5 million instead of 250,000, and we still probably wouldn't be there in terms of the number of people we need to train the skills. I'm curious, any specific lessons from that you would want to talk about in terms of like the curriculum that you developed? How long does it take? What are the relative rates of success that, say, a paraprofessional who's been able to learn some of these skills in terms of their ability to change somebody's life versus, say, a trained psychologist?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm in the fourth edition of this, if I think about sort of really disseminating CBT. And the first project we did was pretty heavy. So the project with ROCA, which is a nonprofit dealing with young men coming out of prison, that was a 5-year implementation project. We did 3 curriculums. We iterated. We literally like were on the ground. Then we were able to decrease that significantly. The model that we currently have is a model of 38 weeks, which is interesting because the community organizations find it to be too long. And yet psychologists are trained by 7 years, right? But in 38 weeks, I do the training remotely to, so there's 5 skills now. I do the training. The training is at 2 hours. And then we have weekly coaching, because the most important thing is actually applying, teaching people to apply, giving them homework, right? And the motto is you have to regulate yourself first. And so you have to apply the skills to yourself, because if you can't regulate yourself, you know, this is a pyramid.
Or put on the mask, right?
If you think about this, when my 7-year-old is having a temper tantrum, if I can't cool off, this is going to explode. And so the idea is that we train them to cool off their brain first, understand the brain, and then apply. And in 38 weeks, we have really good success. I mean, we had this project in Connecticut with 3 organizations, and we just signed a contract with Dalu again for now 10 organizations that we're going to be training. And we're now creating a certification process so that they can certify people internally. So there's a true train-the-trainer model.
I love that. And it's also... it's interesting. I see this as part of a larger trend of extending what we have learned about mental and behavioral health into the culture, right? So I drop my 3-year-old off every day at nursery school, and one of the books that's in her nursery school is a book about breathing. It's about, you know, it's a book about a 3-year-old having a temper tantrum because somebody has taken their cute little dinosaur, somebody's knocked over their block tower, the other dinosaur is upset about it. And the whole book is about, you know, taking a moment to step away and take 10 deep breaths, and then learning to think about something that's pleasant. And to me, that what this is like, we've as the field has moved forward, and psychiatrists and psychologists have started to understand the mind better and what is actually effective in terms of modifying behaviors, it's important, of course, that they can work directly with their patients, but there's no reason that learning to breathe or learning to be mindful or learning to reframe your inaccurate thoughts, your catastrophizing thoughts, can't be something that becomes more and more mainstream, both in terms of the way popular culture portrays it, its portrayal in books, and then also in sort of training these paraprofessionals to deliver the skills to people who need to learn them.
And I think that's the only way we're going to make a significant dent, right? Outside of the U.S., we've seen this. We see all of this task shifting, task sharing. There's that great paper of grandmothers sitting on bench in Africa teaching CBT to kids that come talk to them and the effects on this. So like outside the U.S., we knew that we couldn't train enough people. My friend Deb Kaysen, who's at Stanford, did a great study in the Congo, cognitive processing therapy in the Congo with paraprofessionals. Like we knew we could do it. In the U.S., we've been like, no, we have to train more, you know, professionals. It's not going to close the gap. And my personal mission is to put this in the water. I learned CBT from my grandmother. She forced me to talk to strangers when I was terrified at 15, when I thought I wasn't good enough, that I wasn't smart enough, that I wasn't pretty enough. She forced me to talk to strangers in the mall. And that shifted my entire life. I could have developed social phobia and I didn't. And if we can teach this to youth, I mean, I just had a moment with my son. We were in Rio de Janeiro for the holidays. And he took a tumble when he came out of the ocean, like he was trying to surf and he got hurt and he came out and he's like, I don't want to do it anymore. And I said, what would happen if you don't go back in the ocean? He says, I'll be afraid. I'll be afraid of the ocean. I said, okay. In our family, when we're scared, what do? He's seven, Mark. He looked at me and said, we approach, we don't avoid, mom. I said, what are we going to do? We're going to get back on the ocean.
That's amazing. That is the Brazilian version of get back on the horse, I suppose.
That's it. No, don't avoid. And so he went back. And I've been using that clip on my lectures recently because it's really important to think about that. In the process of learning and training your brain, we're going to fall off the horse, but you have to get back on the horse.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so much embedded wisdom there. And I love that story. I think that as a father of a 9-year-old and a 3-year-old, very practical for the parenting, but also for myself. I think the challenge is, I think it's one of the most interesting things about all of this is even with all the training, even with all the skills, much like with say physical exercise, it is something that you have to continue to do and continue to practice because it will always be a little bit more pleasant to avoid.
100%.
That's it. Every day. And so you like step into it, face it, take it on. That's really interesting.
I just last year recorded a course with John Cena and on Bold Move. And so we released this course. But the interesting thing that he said to me, which I totally love, he's like, you have to train for life. And he's like, it took me a long time to understand that I needed to dedicate the same effort I did to my physical training my brain. And that what I need today at 40 is different than what I need when I was 30. But you're going to have to train for life. And I think we forget that the brain's an organ that needs to be exercised. Like we focus on our six packs, but not in our brain. And I think it's so important to normalize. It is a lifelong journey. It's not a 12-week process.
That's fantastic. And I also don't want to lose the thread. It's just very interesting work that you and your colleagues have done thinking about this in the developing world as well, where it's interesting. I'd love perhaps to talk to your colleague who did the study in the Congo, because I'm reminded a little bit of when mobile technologies came out, how they were adopted more quickly actually in the developing world than in the US, because it was the infrastructure with landlines in the US and people like, do I actually need this mobile? And while we don't have enough therapists, we do have 250,000 therapists, and we do have a psychological infrastructure in place to sort of support people. I think in the developing world, there's probably none of that infrastructure. And so you're just going to sort of leapfrog this and push right into the community, teach the skills within the community, and then teach the teachers, and be very interesting to see what those results look like. So thank you, Lana. This was such a wonderful conversation. So many interesting threads. For those who haven't seen the book, Bold Move, it is terrific. You can find it on Amazon, and I recommend it highly. Really appreciate the time today, and look forward to further conversations.
Thank you, Mark. It was lovely to be here with you.
Thanks for listening to Neural Compass, the Jiminy podcast. If today's conversation sparked something for you, explore more at jiminyhealth.com, where we're building the future of mental health care with clinically effective, modern, continuous support. See you next time.